It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, a look at the relationship between the U.S. and Russia after President Obama cancels a planned meeting with his Russian counterpart.
Now, a look back at the U.S. war in Vietnam. Our guest is the author of a new book on the American military in Vietnam. He makes the case that violence against citizens was the norm, not the exception.
Nick Turse is the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. He's speaking today in Milwaukee at Boswell Books, tomorrow in Madison at the Veterans for Peace National Convention. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we get into the stories that you tell in your book, why it's decades after this war, you spent years researching these stories. Why do you think these stories need to be told now?
Well, I thought there was a compelling reason for historical purposes. You know, we have 30,000 books on the Vietnam War in print, if you can believe it, but not one that attempts to tell the complete story of what I came to see as the signature aspect of the conflict, Vietnamese civilian suffering. And then, another reason is I do believe it has contemporary relevance because, the U.S. now has been fighting a series of serial wars and... We don't see generally on the nightly news or the front page of the newspapers what the effect is on civilians. So I think it has some contemporary relevance as well.
Going back to the era, the massacre at My Lai got a lot of attention when it came to light, thanks to a whistleblower and reporting. It's been written about a lot since. You say it's been treated as the exception in the Vietnam War, but this wasn't an isolated case. Massacres like that were more common than we know. Why?
Well, why we don't know about the other massacres?
Well, first of all, how common was that sort of thing?
Well, there were many massacres. This wasn't an aberration the way that My Lai has been portrayed. But most Vietnamese civilians weren't killed in My Lai type massacres. They were killed by heavy firepower. And the reason why was really because of the way that the U.S. fought the war. This wasn't a conflict fought by conventional means, two armies facing off across a battlefield a la World War I. Vietnam was a guerrilla war, and the U.S. wasn't trying to take territory, trying to capture an enemy capital. Basically, they were flailing around at the beginning of the war looking for a metric, a measure, to show that they were winning the war. What they settled on was the body count. Basically, the idea was that you would kill your way to victory. You would kill so many enemy troops that the enemy could not replace them. And then the idea was that the Vietnamese revolutionary forces would sue for peace. This was the way it was dreamed up in the Pentagon. What they did was put tremendous pressure on the commanders and troops out in the field to produce bodies. But as the war went on, they really weren't exacting about who those bodies belonged to. Very quickly, the phrase, if it's dead in Vietnamese, it's VC, Viet Cong, the enemy guerrillas. That became a defining dictum of the war, and any Vietnamese body would do.
Even civilians?
Even civilians.
And as you say, this is a guerrilla war. The American case there, I guess, was we don't know when we go into a village who the enemy, the Viet Cong are, and who the villagers are. How did they deal with that confusion?
Well, it was a very complex environment, and you have to remember that the average infantry soldier in the Vietnam War, American, was 18, 19, 20 years old. These men were told to go out and produce Vietnamese bodies. They learned very quickly that their commanders really didn't care who those bodies belonged to. They were generally hit with sniper attacks and booby traps. They didn't generally see the enemy face to face. They weren't able to fight a conventional war. And they took to basically firing at anyone they saw. They were told that that the guerrillas wore black pajamas, is what their commanders told them. These were the loose-fitting clothes that were worn by the guerrillas, but also by the average Vietnamese farmer in the countryside. So they would see fleeting glimpses of someone running in black pajamas and fire at them. It might be a guerrilla with a rifle, but it might be a woman farmer holding a hoe, a farm implement. And this was commonplace throughout the war. Troops really were in an uncertain environment. They were scared, and they had a difficult time telling friend from foe.
And you write about another part of the policy being to relocate entire villages of Vietnamese, mostly farmers. I think draining the pool was one of the phrases the military used. By clearing people out of that area, then we'll know that anybody left is the enemy, I guess. Paint a picture. You actually talk about what happened in some of those raids, I guess, to relocate villages.
Well, basically, they would send in infantry troops into a village. Generally, the Vietnamese civilians had maybe a day, maybe an hour, maybe no time at all, and they were told, you have to get out of this area. It would be declared what they called a free fire zone, meaning that that anyone left in the area would be considered a fair game, a target. And the troops would begin setting fire to the homes and burn the home down with all the possessions inside. And this was a commonplace during the war for whole hamlets or entire villages, a collection of hamlets, to be burnt down, and the people marched off to a refugee camp. Generally, these were a squalid affair. The people weren't able to farm at the refugee camps. There weren't enough supplies, and they would end up filtering back into the countryside, back to their ruined hamlets to try and eke out an existence. Scrape by with whatever had survived the fire, try and scavenge vegetables from their gardens. And this brought them back into the countryside, which the U.S. had declared a free fire zone and made them de facto targets.
In researching this book, you talked to a lot of U.S. veterans who served in Vietnam. How did they react when you contacted them to track down the stories you wrote about?
Well, I had responses across the spectrum. There were some veterans that I contacted. I had in hand many detailed records, criminal investigations files that the Army carried out in the late 1960s, early 1970s. So I had the sworn testimony of these men, but I would go back to them and talk to them. Some were unrepentant. There was one man that always comes to mind. I had documents that said that he had admitted torturing Vietnamese non-combatants, prisoners and civilians. He used electrical torture, water torture, what we now call waterboarding, as well as beatings. And, I asked him about that, and he said that he thought it was entirely correct behavior. If he was in a Vietnam-type situation again, he said that he would definitely act in the same manner. He thought it was in the best interest of the country to do so. A more common response was there was one infantryman that I talked to. He spent a year in Vietnam. We were talking for, it was a marathon session, maybe 4 or 5 hours. And he was very gregarious, had a big booming voice, an infectious laugh. But then he quieted down and told me that he wanted to tell me a story about a member of his unit. And he said that they were going into a village one day and setting on fire, which was standard operating procedure. And a woman came up to this GI in his unit and began grabbing on his sleeve. She was yelling, crying, obviously because her home was going up in flames. And he said that this soldier pushed her off once. She came back, and then he took the butt of his M16 rifle and hit her squarely in the nose. Broke her nose, there was blood everywhere, she was screaming, and he said that the GI just turned around and walked away laughing. And then, he paused for a moment and said, you know that the GI I'm telling you about was me. And, I had a tough time linking up the man I was talking to his 19-year-old self, and he told me that he had the same problem. He couldn't believe that he had done that, that he was able to walk away laughing after doing this, and he said that at the time, he didn't think anything of it, but in the years since, it had never left his mind, and he thought of it constantly, and he thought of other things that had gone on in Vietnam that were similar experiences, and I think that was more, more typical of what I heard. These were men who were called upon to do, some very hard things as 19, 20-year-olds, and now they've had to live with it in the decades since.
Talking to them and doing the research that you did, where do you point the blame for these things happening?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can ever excuse individual culpability. There were men, plenty of men that I talked to who didn't take part. There were men who tried to intervene, or when they came home, they spoke up on behalf of Vietnamese victims. But, you know, I really think the blame was at the command level. You know, these troops were put in, you know, quite untenable situations, and they were either ordered in many cases to commit atrocities, or there was a wink and nod attitude where they knew what they were expected to do, and they knew that that the command wouldn't take any action against them when they did carry these atrocities out.
We're talking to Nick Turse about his book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. When we come back, we'll talk about why America didn't hear these stories sooner.
You can join the conversation with your questions and reactions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time.
We'll continue our discussion now with Nick Turse. His book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick, you touched on just before the break how soldiers reacted at the time. Some of them tried to blow the whistle. They tried to take it up the chain of command and report what they saw as atrocities, as war crimes. What happened when they did that?
Well, you know, generally this wasn't it was hard for troops in the field to report any war crimes. A lot of times they were taking their life into their hands if they did so. There's one veteran I talk about in the book named Jamie Henry, who was a medic. You know, he didn't want to go to war, but he was drafted and you know, served with great distinction, won a number of medals, saved a lot of American lives. But he was shocked by what he saw in the field. On his first day, he watched as the point man, the lead man of his patrol, molested a young girl. And he said, you know, to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place. A young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. But when Jamie spoke up about brutality, his life was threatened. And even his friends came up to him afterward and said, look, you really have to keep your mouth shut or you're going to get shot in the back during a firefight and no one's going to be the wiser. And this was something that I heard again and again. There were men who really feared for their lives and also feared that if they didn't carry out their orders, they would be court-martialed and thrown in prison. So it was very tough to blow the whistle in Vietnam.
Why was a whistleblower successful at exposing the massacre in My Lai and not the other people you're talking about?
Well, the whistleblower in the My Lai case actually wasn't at My Lai. Ron Ridenour was a GI who served with some of the men who committed the massacre at My Lai, but he was transferred out of that unit before the massacre, and it was only when he caught up with them later and got the stories that he was able to then piece together what had happened at My Lai, and he collected what was in essence hearsay evidence, and then sent that once he got home to 30 power brokers in Washington. But the men who were at My Lai, there were none who blew the whistle on it. There was one man who was that the commanders there feared might blow the whistle. And he was threatened in Vietnam and left out in the field almost into his final days. He was convinced that they were trying to, you know, put him on the front line so he would be killed before he went home and would have a chance to talk.
I was looking around at responses to your book. One common theme just in comments on the internet is this was war. There were massacres committed by the enemy, the North Vietnamese, the insurgents we called the Viet Cong. Is it unfair to single out American atrocities in that context? How do you respond to that kind of criticism?
Well, I certainly don't deny atrocities on the other side. I think they should be investigated. I think the light of day should be shown upon them. But it doesn't, you know, this doesn't take away the responsibility that that America has under international law and under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. and the oath that that soldiers swear. You know, Americans say that they hold themselves to a higher standard, and it really was the American military that pioneered the laws of war. We were the country that started this, so it's a tradition that you know, that the U.S. military is steeped in, and I think it's right and in the best traditions of America that that war crimes be prosecuted as they're supposed to be under international law and under U.S. military law, and that they are exposed so that citizens know exactly what war entails.
Another concern I've seen is veterans survived a trauma. They face stigma. In many cases, when they return to the country, why expose them to this by bringing these issues out?
Well, you know, a lot of the veterans that I've talked to since this book came out have said that, you know, far from re-traumatizing them, that this book finally enabled them to speak openly and honestly about the war. There have been many veterans who've written to me who said, you know, that this book finally offered them validation. One veteran who said that, you know, for 40 years he's been trying to tell people about the war as he saw it. And, you know, he told me that he was, either people told him that he was a liar or they just didn't want to hear it. And he said, now I have irrefutable proof. You know, my book has sworn testimony from hundreds and hundreds of veterans who, from different units at different times all across the country, he finally understood that this wasn't his unit, that this was a widespread problem, and now, you know, he felt validation that that he could finally talk honestly about the war.
In your book, you try to bring out another perspective, that of the Vietnamese people themselves. What kind of stories did you encounter?
Well, I went to Vietnam the first time with stacks of documents in hand, and I go to a hamlet or village, and I seek out witnesses and survivors of one particular atrocity that I had in the records. But what the Vietnamese would tell me about time and again was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and artillery shells and helicopter gunships, how they negotiated every aspect of their lives around the American war. And as I heard the story again and again, I quickly realized that that the story that I really wanted to tell wasn't one simply of war crimes, but of Vietnamese civilian suffering, what it was like to live through the American war, as they call it. And that really transformed my project. You know, I'd gone to Vietnam after writing a 1,200-page dissertation of the topic. I thought I knew what the war was about, but I really didn't have any clue until I talked to the Vietnamese about the war as they experienced it.
Just give us, we just have a couple minutes left, can you give us a feeling about one of the stories you heard, say, from one of the Vietnamese people you talked to?
Well, there was a woman that I mentioned briefly in Kill Anything That Moves named Ho Thi A, and I had read about a massacre in a tiny hamlet called Le Bac Tu, and I traveled there because the documents I had said that there was one survivor, a little girl. And I eventually found that this was the woman. And she told me, you know, matter-of-factly about how she'd been in a bomb shelter as American Marines came into her hamlet. And she was sheltering there with her grandmother and an elderly neighbor. And they emerged to find a Marine standing right in front of their bomb shelter. And he leveled his rifle and shot the old ladies down, one and then the other. And this little girl, Ho Thi A, wheeled around and scrambled back into the bunker. And the soldier, the Marine, threw a couple grenades in after her, but she wasn't hit by the shrapnel, and she survived. And, you know, she told me the story rather calmly. But then a little later on, she teared up. It was after I had turned to some more mundane questions. And she broke down. She didn't, you know, just cry or sob. She had a complete emotional break. She was crying convulsively for 10, 15, about 20 minutes. You know, and I've done a lot of difficult interviews like this, but I hadn't encountered anything quite like it. And you know, it really drove home to me how, you know, she was living, you know, just you know, a few hundred feet from where this took place. And it drove home to me what it was like for the Vietnamese to, you know, live with the legacy of the war day after day, year after year, decade after decade. And this is what I found again and again in Vietnam, people who had moved on, but, you know, the war was still very fresh to them. I mean, these were some of the most horrific incidents imaginable that they'd lived through. And I felt lucky that they were willing to share it with me.
Nick, thank you for joining us to share those stories.
Thanks very much for having me on.
As Nick Turse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, speaking later today at Boswell Books.
Coming up, a look at relations between U.S. and Russia. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In just a bit, we'll look at some new technology that could allow cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we take a look at U.S.-Russia relations. President Obama announced today that he's canceling a planned meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The decision comes amid tension over NSA leaker Edward Snowden.
Is this just a diplomatic snub, or is there more to it? And as we head down the rocky road to the 2014 Winter Olympics in Russia, what can we expect from both countries? Joining us now is Pierre Atlas. He's professor of political science and director of global studies at Marion University. Pierre, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how rocky are U.S.-Russian relations right about now?
Well, they're definitely in a rough patch. There are a lot of issues that are on the table, causing a lot of controversy. And the Snowden issue is just the latest. And you know, I think the real reason for why the summit was canceled.
And that the Snowden reason, Edward Snowden, who revealed all those leaks about the NSA in Russia getting temporary sanctuary, was that, do you think, and I know you're not inside the mind of Vladimir Putin, but was that a calculated snub of the United States?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, I would say it was. The Russians would say that technically it's a government ministry decision, not Putin's himself, to grant the temporary asylum. But I think clearly the Russians granted it with his approval and probably with his intent. So I think part of it was definitely a snub. To be honest, though, if you think about what other options did Russia have with Snowden, you know, they couldn't let him stay indefinitely in the airport forever. Something had to be done. Had they released him and let him go to a Latin American country where he would get asylum, where his passport has already been withdrawn, he technically is not allowed to fly on an airplane. Had they let him go, that would have been probably even a bigger insult to the United States. And then there is a sense of Russian national pride, the fact that there is no extradition treaty with the United States, and this idea that Russia wants to be treated as an equal, and basically doing the bidding for the United States from the Russian perspective, and just letting him go back to the United States when there is no extradition treaty, that might have been seen as Russia giving in. So I think it was probably, overall, the different choices that Russia had, this was probably the option that was the easiest for them to do, which was to grant Snowden a temporary asylum.
You know, diplomats, state departments, that sort of thing, put so much time into careful negotiations and planning, and it seems like every so often you get this weird, fluky event that throws things all akimbo. Is this just the story of diplomacy?
That certainly can be the case. I think, again, here, Snowden was the ultimate reason for canceling, or as the Obama administration say, they're postponing the summit. But really, if you think about it, you want to hold a summit, a major diplomatic summit, when you think you can accomplish something. And there really wasn't any likelihood of anything positive coming out of this summit. There are so many issues that the U.S. and Russia are at loggerheads over, whether it's Syria or arms control or Russia's crackdown on internal dissent and other human rights issues, trade, this new anti-gay law. I mean, a lot of different issues that are really kind of the U.S. And Russia are going nowhere. The summit probably would not have accomplished anything anyway. So in some ways, Snowden, which was seen as a slap in the face to the U.S., was sort of an ideal opportunity, in my opinion, to go ahead and cancel the summit rather than go forward. Even without Snowden, nothing positive probably would have come out of this. And then it would have just been a photo op that would have been kind of empty.
Well, let's dig into a couple of those issues you just mentioned and start with Syria. Where are the U.S. and Russia when it comes to being anywhere near an agreement on what to do about Syria?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Okay.
They, Russia is fully supporting the Assad regime. If anything, they've doubled down on it. It's really the last foothold that Russia has in the Arab world. They're supporting the regime for lots of reasons. Affinity with the Christian minority, the fact that they have access to a military base, they're selling weapons, they're getting cash. There's a sense, again, of national pride that this is sort of like their last foothold in the Arab world. There are a lot of reasons for that. They also want to oppose the United States. They have very much stronger relations with Iran, obviously, than we do, and Iran and Russia are on the same side in supporting their regime. There's a lot of factors there that motivate them to take the position that they are in. And there really isn't a lot of motivation for them to change their position. I think, you know, they could be convinced to do so, but that's a long way off.
Well, President Obama was on with Jay Leno last night. He said, quote, "There are times when Russia slips back into Cold War thinking and a Cold War mentality." Is that fair? Is there a Cold War mentality within Russia?
You know, I saw that. I think that's true to a certain extent. In some ways, my sense of Putin isn't so much that he wants to return to the Soviet Union. I think he kind of wants to return to the Tsarist era of Russia, where Russia again had a major influence in the world. He isn't, you know, interested in going back to totalitarianism, but he certainly is cracking down on dissent. And wants Russia to have a major position in the world, and doesn't like the idea that the United States is sort of seeing them as less relevant. I mean, we're focusing on China. We're pivoting to the Pacific. I think Russia is sort of saying, "Hey, what about us? We want to still count." And there's a tremendous amount of suspicion towards the United States in Europe. I mean, with the missile defense and a lot of other issues, Syria and elsewhere. So I think it's easy to say it's Cold War, and in some ways that certainly looks that way. But it's not. I wouldn't take it to the full extent and say that, you know, they want to return to the bad old days of the Soviet Union, for example.
What does this look like from inside Russia? Are people weighing a trade-off maybe between some of the crackdowns you mentioned and having Russia have a place in the sun on the international stage?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Some Russian human rights activists have been saying that they actually thought that granting Snowden asylum was a good thing, that was actually consistent with sort of international human rights understandings of asylum. But then at the same time, they were saying, but clearly the Russian government would not treat their own whistleblowers that way. And in some I was looking at some sources here. Some human rights activists and organizations in Russia were saying that they just wish that Russia would do this, would be consistent, you know, in that sense. But again, I think there is a sense of national pride that Russia is a major player, and that they're being taken seriously. On the other hand, the other hand, they are cracking down even harder on their own internal dissent, and that certainly is not popular with a lot of Russians.
Do people feel that sense of history in Russia? You know, we had Peter the Great, we beat Napoleon, we beat Hitler. We are a major power, and the world should treat us that way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And not only that, economically, people felt that they were, you know, they're looking back. A lot of people looking back to the Soviet Union with nostalgia, which is kind of ironic because they seem to have forgotten about the bread lines and things like that. And obviously the loss of freedom. But the idea of, you know, high unemployment, of people not being able to put food on the table, old people being, you know, basically, you know, eating dog food and things like this. That also sort of reminds them of, you know, how far we've come down. And Putin is I think taking advantage of that to restore a sense of nostalgia, taking advantage of that sense of nostalgia. Also, I think it is important that, you know, just like, you know, President Obama and American leaders have domestic audiences, Putin has a domestic audience too. So not only everything he's doing is also to bolster his own credibility and legitimacy within the country, and picking on the United States for a lot of people is an easy target.
2014 Winter Olympics are coming up in Russia. Is that going to be a political football or discus? No, wait, that's a Summer Olympic one. But is it going to be a political beast there?
It could be. I mean, I know there's some people here who are saying that, you know, the United States should, for example, boycott that. I think I heard Lindsey Graham say that. I think that's not going to happen, and that would certainly be a mistake. One of the more interesting things that will happen, I mean, obviously every country that hosts the Olympics, it's a very big deal for that country. This will be a very big deal for Russia. They're going to make a lot out of it. One of the interesting things is this new conflict over the anti-gay law that makes what they call homosexual propaganda illegal, which is basically any kind of advocacy of gay rights is a crime. And it'll be interesting to see how that impacts on the Olympics. And there was an interesting article today in the New York Times about that not only will Russia be cracking down on this, but so will the International Olympic Committee, which prohibits any athletes from making any kind of political statement. So if you have an Olympian who wants to show gay pride or something, he or she might actually be sent home by the IOC or perhaps arrested by the Russians. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting thing to watch.
Moving forward, as long as we're talking about President Obama and President Putin, are things going to get any better, or is there going to have to be a change of leadership before things might warm up?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think it's safe to say that President Putin will be in power long after President Obama leaves office. And then the question is, even if whoever replaces Obama, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, will they have a better shot at it? I mean, we could sort of do a counterfactual. Had Mitt Romney won the election in 2012, do you think we would be having a better relationship with Russia? I don't think we would. In fact, if anything, Romney had signaled that he would take a stronger, harsher stance against Russia, and I don't think that would have necessarily made a better relationship. You know, presidents in their second term start thinking about legacy, and one of the easiest ways to build your legacy is in foreign policy. That a lot of presidents have done that, and it could very well be that you know, Obama will try and take an opportunity out of this. I mean, things are pretty low. You know, both the United States and Russia want to have better relations with each other. It's in their interest to do so. And perhaps, you know, they can work something out. Maybe there'll be an opportunity or a silver lining out of this, the postponed summit. Maybe they can get something out of it.
Pierre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Pierre Atlas. He's professor of political science and director of global studies at Marion University.
Coming up next, we'll look at a new technology that could allow cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When it comes to treating cancer, one of the first questions on a person's mind is often, will I lose my hair?
Doctors say their patients aren't concerned about hair loss out of vanity. They say it's an outward symbol of an illness they wish to keep private sometimes.
But new experimental technologies called cold caps might make it easier for cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. Here to talk about it is Dr. Hope Rugo. She's a clinical professor in health sciences and director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Rugo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, give us a little overview. What are cold caps? How do they work?
So cold caps, actually, this is the idea of making the scalp and the blood vessels that feed the hair follicles that make the hair cool. So you make it cool, blood flow decreases, metabolism decreases. And the idea is two things. One is you deliver less chemotherapy to the hair follicles so that you try and prevent the damage to those cells. And the second thing is you reduce the metabolism of those cells so that they don't maybe need as much blood in order to stay alive. And by doing both of those things, you can potentially prevent the chemotherapy damage to hair follicles, which is an unintended and not valuable side effect from chemotherapy.
Hmm. And based on your research so far, how much hair is often saved on account of cold caps?
Well, cold caps have been around for a very long time. It's as I pointed just explained, it's a kind of a simple idea, the idea that you would make it cool, you get less blood flow, we all know that, and you would reduce metabolism. The ability to cool the scalp has changed a lot over three decades, from putting ice around the head where it didn't work very well to using caps that didn't maintain their temperature. But with new materials, the caps are much better, and there's two main ways to cool the scalp. And with these mechanisms of cooling the scalp, patients maintain more than 50% of their hair, the majority of patients. Some of it has to do with the type of chemotherapy. Some has to do with your own hair itself, how much baseline hair loss you have. And then the lastly, of course, the way the caps are used, you know, how well they're fitted to the scalp. We don't use scalp cooling for some kinds of cancers that are everywhere at once, like a leukemia, for example, that's in the blood, because possibly that might do some downside in terms of the effect of the chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Did you say 15% of hair or 50?
50. Yeah. And, you know, of course, for many of the chemotherapy regimens we give to women with breast cancer, where my work is focused, the patients will keep more than 75% of their hair. So they have thinning. Hair still falls out, but the majority of the hair is present. And what that ends up resulting in is either they don't have to wear any head covering, or if they had developed an area of thinning and need to wear a head covering at some point to feel comfortable, their hair will fill in much more quickly than if they lose their entire head of hair.
What's the level of discomfort that a patient might feel, though, as they're wearing these cold caps?
Well, cold caps, you know, they're cold.
Yeah.
And we go down to 3 to 5 degrees or so, and then I think, you know, centigrade, most people tolerate it pretty well. Some people are very sensitive to the cold effect, and what we found is that it is the cooling process that is most uncomfortable. It's kind of like having a brain freeze from eating ice cream on a hot day. So if people stay warm and drink some warm tea, and sometimes they'll take a Tylenol or Motrin Advil-type medication, they generally tolerate the cooling process well, and then to maintain the cold temperature seems to be much better tolerated.
Hmm. Well, you had mentioned that cold caps have been around for a while, but here in the U.S., it still hasn't been approved by the FDA. I'm curious what is still under consideration before it would be approved for widespread use.
Well, as I mentioned, there's two main ways that cooling can be accomplished. And then there's a lot of other companies now that are very interested in making cooling products. One is a cold cap system that is put in a freezer the day before you get the chemotherapy, and you put the cap on out of the freezer, and then you have to change it every 20 minutes as it warms up. So that's one type of scalp cooling. The second type of scalp cooling is a machine that actually has a coolant that circulates through the cap so that you put the cap on and you basically just sit there. The advantage of that second system is that it alleviates the patient of any responsibility or cost in terms of renting or purchasing the cold caps. There are obviously, if these are used more routinely, there will be some cost just to having the machine in that facility and placing the cap on. But you don't need a freezer, and the coolant circulates through the cap and maintains a cold temperature. When you use cooling caps, you put them on so that the scalp is already cool before you start the chemo, so about a half an hour beforehand. And then you have to keep the cap on for at least 2 hours afterwards while the sort of heavy doses of chemotherapy are cleared from your system. So that's how they work. Now, the question is, why aren't they approved? 30 years ago, 25 years ago, there was concern that maybe if you prevented the chemotherapy in its highest doses from reaching the scalp, that you might get scalp metastases, or cancer might come back on the scalp. Mm. There was also concern that it didn't work well. We've now shown in large data sets that the risk of having scalp metastases is very low in breast cancer and not higher with scalp cooling. So we went to the FDA and we said, with this second system made by a company called Dignitana, where patients come in and put the cap on during their chemo through this circulating coolant from a machine, what would we need to do to get FDA approval? The first thing they wanted us to do was a 20-patient pilot, although this has been used in thousands of patients worldwide, not in the U.S. So we did a 20-patient pilot with Wake Forest University, our partners in developing this protocol, and showed that it was very effective and well-tolerated in the majority of women. So now we're opening and have had an FDA clearance to open a larger trial in 100 women where hopefully those results will be able to be presented to the FDA for approval of this device. And what that means is then patients can use it because centers might purchase it, and potentially in the future we will be able to get a small amount of insurance reimbursement as well.
What's the timeline on that? What do you foresee in terms of getting approval?
Well, we hope that the trial will enter its first patient this month, and there should be no problem with that. We have 5 centers across the United States that will be participating, and of course there's been great interest from other sites as well. And then I expect that we'll enroll all of the patients within a year, at the most a year and a half, and then we'll have the data fairly quickly afterwards, because our endpoint is just the amount of hair a patient has when they come in for their first visit after the end of chemotherapy. So we should be able to present to the FDA within less than 2 years. Everything always ends up being a little bit slower when you're working with federal agencies, but we have high hopes that that's what will happen.
Great. Well, in the meantime, in our last few seconds, what options do people have right now while it's still in the trial phase, in just a few seconds?
They have the option of renting on their own the Penguin cold caps. And if you search online, you can find the contact information and rent them directly. The man who runs that company, Frank Frond, is extremely helpful for patients, and it works very well. And just as I know we're done with this, but I wanted to mention that this is only possible through the vision of the director of our breast group, Laura Esserman, and through tremendous philanthropic support from the Tauber Foundation.
Well, Dr. Rugo, thank you so much.
Thank you for highlighting this project.
Dr. Hope Rugo is clinical professor in health sciences and director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, how ADA medication affects children in the classroom. That's tomorrow on Central Time. And coming up after the news, we'll talk to you about your best and worst vacation experiences. And you can start calling in now, actually, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Verrett.
I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.